philosophy. Think Plato's cave, people being drawn out from ignorance into the light, into thoughtfulness. That's what the root word, educare, means, to draw out. Think of a well, a deep well. And if you've ever, anybody been on a farm? Or I remember I was on a farm the first time I actually saw a real well, and I looked deep, you know, and you can't see to the bottom. And if you're stuck in a well, you need help being brought out into the light. And that's what the word, the root word, means. And to teach and to educate is a sacred act. So I honestly do thank you for being here. I thank Christ Church for the opportunity to teach and for you to participate. All right, so what are we talking about? You know, why are we talking about this? Everybody get a handout? There should be enough handouts going around. What does it mean to be human is actually why we're talking about this. This is the doctrine of Christian anthropology. This is the whole lens. This is the thread that we're going to weave through the next 8 weeks. The doctrine of Christian anthropology. What does it mean to be human, to be made in the image of God, and to be incarnational in the space on the earth as we are? What does it mean to be human? Because this is the fundamental question. Psalm 8, I'll just read it for you. Psalm 8, O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth, who have set your glory above the heavens. Out of the mouth of babes and nursing infants you have ordained strength, because of your enemies, that you may silence the enemy and the avenger. When I consider your heavens and the works of your fingers, the moon, the stars, which you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him? For you have made him a little lower than the angels, and you have crowned him with glory and honor. You have made him to have dominion over the works of your hands. You have put all things under his feet, all the sheep and oxen, even the beasts of the field, the birds of the air, the fish of the sea that pass through the paths of the sea. O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name. That psalm, Psalm 8, follows directly the litany from Genesis 1. If we remember, we're going to go all the way back to the beginning. In the beginning, God what? God created. God by nature is creative. In the beginning, God created. And for 26 more verses, it goes on to talk about how he created, what he created, why he created. God is creative by nature. And then we get to verse 26, and what does the scripture say? Let us make man in our image. In our image. We are made to be co-creative, analogous to the Creator. From day one, think about the garden. Work sometimes is confounded, right? Work, we talk about kind of post-fall. Work is full of toil. Childbearing is full of toil, the work. But work was ordained pre-fall. What were the types of work that happened in the garden? Think with me. What are the types of work? Tending the garden. What does that mean? You're right on. Think of those of you. Pruning, fertilizing. What else? What else happened in the garden? Think with me. I mean, these are harken back to Sunday school as a child, but there's harvesting, right? Of apples and, well, maybe not apples. What else happened? Think of the text. Naming, taxonomies, naming the animals. Wow, what a job. I mean, think about what we go through naming our children. And here Adam gets the opportunity to name all of the creatures in front of him, the original taxonomy. That's a lot of responsibility. But there was a lot of creative work that happened pre-fall. And so in verse 26, he says, let us make man in our image, and that thereby, because of that, we participate in this creation narrative. So I want you to, in the forefront of your mind, to think to be made in the image of God is analogous to being co-creative with him. It's part of the nature that we share in that creative experience. So when I say technology, second point, technology, the one thing about Genesis that we learn is that he brings what out of chaos? Order. Order. Order out of chaos. Order out of chaos. Order out of chaos. Naming, taxonomies. What is this thing? How do we know it? For him to say, do not eat of the tree, he had to know what tree is. He had to know direction. He had to know. There are so many things that fall order out of chaos. And of course, we ate the apple. We fall into original sin. We choose sin. And so we inherit a sinful nature along with this co-creative nature. That is the tension of what it means to be human in the world today. And so when we talk about technology, what immediately comes to your mind? I'm a teacher by heart. I'm actually asking these questions. So hit me with this. When I say technology, what comes to mind? Digital. Boom. Most of us digital. What else? Speak up. Screens. Okay, digital screens. What else? Okay, wow, technology. Yeah, wow, that's meta, right? Yeah, technology. Good. What else? Who? Medical. Yeah, yeah. Tools. Medical technology. Biotechnology. Good. What else? The occult. Tell me about that.
Quantum physics.
Okay.
Scrying mirrors.
Okay. Hadn't thought of that one, but that's good. I appreciate that. What do we mean by technology? Anything else? The wheel. Instant gratification. Making things easier. Absolutely. I heard one back here. Creativity. So technology, when we say technology, a lot of modern people, you know, they think the iPhone or something analogous to that. The iPhone's actually only 11 years old. The iPhone is 11 years old. And we'll get to that at a later lecture. But if we think about technology, I need to put a definition. And as you know about any subject in the world, there are always debates about definitions and, you know, who. But this is a definition that's generally accepted. And it's a wordy one. So go with me here. This is from Reed Bain, and he coined this idea in 1937. And it's generally accepted amongst people who think about these ideas. Technology includes all tools, machines, utensils, weapons, instruments, housing, clothing, communicating, transporting, the devices and skills by which we produce and use them. So what does that not cover, right? I'll say it again. Technology includes all tools, machines, utensils, weapons, instruments, housing, clothing, communicating, and transporting these devices and skills by which we produce and use them. Reed Bain, B-A-I-N. So when we think of technology, it goes way back. Largely, we think of taxonomies. How many of you remember learning these in school? Raise your hand. The Stone Age, the Bronze Age, the Iron Age. You remember learning that? Well, what does the word stone, bronze, iron, and steel refer to? What's that? The tools of the age. So you learned history, largely, probably most of you, if you raised your hands, you learned history through the taxonomy of the tools that were created in the specific historical timeline. Are you with me? So that's how we learn. We learn, it's just the water in which we swim. The water in which we swim. And so we need to think about technology, though. This is going to be the core of what my three lectures and conversations with you are going to be about. This main key idea. We need to remember not only to think of technology in terms of what it does, but what it undoes. So I want you to write that down. If you have it in front of you, if you have a writing utensil, a writing tool, a technology, which there was, again, a whole debate in Plato about moving from oral culture to alphabet culture, if you're familiar with that, in Plato's Phaedrus. I mean, this argument is not new. All technology has always caused disruption of some kind, moving from an oral culture to a written culture. So write this down again. We need to remember that not only to think of technology in terms of what it does, but what it undoes. Technology is not neutral. Technology cannot be neutral. So we must think of technology, what it does and what it undoes. And this is why. The technological character of our age, if you're familiar with anybody familiar with David Foster Wallace, the existential writer and thinker? David Foster Wallace has this classic analogy. I don't even think it's original with him, but it goes simply like this. You know, if you ask a goldfish about the water in which he's, you know, how's the water? And the goldfish responds, and I'm going to say a naughty word here real quick, don't be offended. But the goldfish responds, what the hell's water? What's water? Why does the goldfish respond that way? Because the ecology, the environment in which he swims, is so ubiquitous to his ordinary everyday life, he doesn't see it. He doesn't recognize it. And David Foster Wallace says we need to be awoken to see the culture, the water in which we swim, which so many of us take for granted. I take the water for granted. And today, technology, even though it's an age-old question, it is much more the water in which we swim in our modern world, and we take it for granted, and we don't ask the questions, what is water? What is technology? What does it do, and what does it undo for us? And this is probably, some of you are thinking, this is downright un-American. Progress, technology, moving us forward. I mean, this is Alexis de Tocqueville in his famous writing about the American experiment said, optimism is one of the chief virtues of the American. We're always optimistic. We're always, you know, progress will lead us, technology will lead us to the virtuous end. And I'm going to take a little, you know, I'm going to put the brakes on and say, let us think about technology, what it does and what it undoes, because technology always undoes things. So list some technologies for me, given that historical scope that we could talk about the Stone Age, the Bronze Age, the Steel Age. What are some technologies, and using the definition I laid out, that the technology includes all of those things, what are some technologies? Just autos, okay? What else? Say it loudly, I didn't. Printing press, yeah. Telephone, okay, I heard road. Good one there. What else? GMOs, absolutely. We'll get there later. What else? Cutting tools. Helmet. I mean, we could be here all day, could we not? What else is missing up here, though? I mean, think outside the box. That's edu-speak, which is nonsense usually. But think broader than this. CERN. What is it? CERN. CER, CERN, yeah, okay. Yep, absolutely, absolutely. Language. Language, boom. What else? Its use would probably be considered technology, but yeah, I mean, obviously, the discovery of and the splitting of caused multiple problems. What? Guns. How about democracy? Forms of government as technology. That is considered technology. How we evolve in thinking politically about the order of things is technology. So I'll just put democracy. but socialism, you could put all kinds of government systems. The system is a technology placed upon the people. Fascinating. So I want you to think broadly when we say technology, to burst you out of this little techno gadget. Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. What couldn't be listed under technology? That's a good way to reverse it, to flip the question. So we could, again, go on all day. I will stop, I promise you. I know some of you are already bored. But I'm trying to push you to think, when we talk about technology, it is a much broader subject. And I don't think we planned for this to be on Reformation Sunday. But whoever said the printing press, you win imaginary bonus points. So the printing press, I will have my whole second lecture on the technological influence and undercurrent that allowed, we sometimes hyper-spiritualize the Reformation. Another, I know that sounds anti-reformed. So I've been anti-American and anti-reformed already. My second lecture is all going to be about the printing press and the what it did and what it undid in the culture, both in theology and throughout many other facets. So the printing press is inevitable in the change of the world as we know it. So let's talk about why is my interest in this? Because largely I started with Psalm 8, and that we are, if Christian anthropology follows, with me here, work with me here, as Christians, if we believe the special revelation and general revelation that we see before us, that we are made in the image of God to be co-creators with Him in His created world. In fact, think, He came as the incarnation. He became flesh to dwell among us. And He was a carpenter. He was a creator in and of Himself for 30 years. The tangible world in which we live has great effect on how we view the world. And this is largely where the modern thinkers, this phrase that I'm going to say here, is what separates that idea from much of the popular academic, technological, engineering thought about technology today. And this is it. Number one. It will change what it means to be human. I could give you a list of 20 names of thinkers who right now are challenging what it means to be human. Modern biotechnology, modern economic systems, modern. What they want from modern technology is to fundamentally change, this is from their own mouth, what it means to be human. Well, transhumanism is a outworking of some of those philosophies, absolutely. So we have to, as Christians, usually Christians, especially American Christians, are usually a decade or two behind the modern thought. And so I want to empower us to be thinking about these types of things theologically in the world in which we live. Because 95% of what we do isn't this, isn't church, isn't Wednesday night's prayer time with it, right? It's out. We're doing our different vocations of which we've been called to do. And we could list all the different vocations that are represented in this room, and I applaud you. But technology is changing the way you do what you do, I guarantee it. And think about it like this. If you put a drop of red dye into a beaker of water, is it now a beaker of water with some red dye in it? What is it by nature? A beaker of red water. The molecules of the water, every molecule takes on the redness. So it's not a beaker of water with red dye in it, it is now red water. And this is what media ecologists, if you want to know, there's a whole discipline called media ecology. And what they argue is the media, the technology that we use, not only we have an iPhone, or we have a television, it's not that we have America with television now. These are what political media ecologists are thinking about. We don't have a America with television. America is a brand new thing when television comes on the scene, even demonstrably more so when the internet comes on the scene. There are different things. It's like the drop of dye. We just don't add things to the ecology. It changes what it is. It's like if those of you who like botany, butterflies and caterpillars. If you take butterflies and caterpillars out of a natural environment, you don't talk about the environment in the same way. It's not like, well, now we have this environment, these woods, without caterpillars or without butterflies. It fundamentally changes the nature of that environment. That's pretty much the same analogous example. It fundamentally changes the ecology of what we're talking about. And again, this is the water in which we swim. We don't notice it. What the heck's technology? You know, what the heck? I don't know. Because I'm in it. I'm grafted to it. How many times do you touch your phone? You've probably seen these statistics. How many times does the average person who has a smartphone touch their phone in a day? Yeah, it's hundreds. It varies, 150 to 300, depending on the study. 150 times you touch this. When I was in church just this morning, I had it in my suit jacket pocket, and it went bzzz. And what was I tempted to do in the middle of Pastor Andrew's sermon? I wonder what's more interesting than this, you know. I didn't, but I had to fight it. We touch these, it changed fundamentally. These are 11 years old. They fundamentally change. And believe it or not, there's a gentleman who has now started his own company who was the design ethicist at Google. They actually have those. Well, he left, so that might be, never mind. He was the design ethicist, and his team think about this. Think about, how many of you have meetings at your workplace? How many of you have meetings at your workplace, right? I mean, we all have meetings. Think about, you're sitting in this meeting, you're in a faculty meeting, you're in a workplace meeting, whatever you're doing, and they said, how can we gain people's attention? Let's create a sound and a vibration that lets people know that their attention is needed elsewhere. And his Google team invented the ding. None of you I know are wowed, because we heard it like three times in the message today. Somebody's phone went ding over here. Mine vibrated in my pocket. Some of yours probably. Somebody had to think that had to be invented. And the design ethicist team came on and said, we are going to invent something that is going to change the attention span of billions of people. No pressure. They had a meeting about what kind of visual stimuli, what kind of auditory stimuli they should do to make sure people knew that their phone wanted their attention. And they had to bandy about whether that, it's going to change fundamentally what people do. And now, years later, we now know that we touch our phones 150 to 300 times. Because it did. So there's forward-looking people saying, how is this technology affecting you and what it means to be human? So, historical overview. Let's get to it. People want to change what it means to be human, and this is where we've come from. How many of you have heard the term industrial revolution before we came into this class, right? I'm not inventing anything here. How many of you have heard the term fourth industrial revolution? Raise your hand. How many of you heard of the term fourth industrial revolution? Okay. So this was a term invented in 2016 and popularized by the World Economic Forum. So if you want to fact check this, which I love teaching, is again, it's a spiritual act because it's transformative, but I am a sinner saved by grace just like you. And so I encourage fact checking of all of this. And that's why I say in 7 weeks, we really can't even scratch the surface. But in 2016, the World Economic Forum said something else is happening in our world that we need to be made aware of. So if you Google World Economic Forum, Fourth Industrial Revolution, they have a whole main page on this. and they have an embedded YouTube video in that main page, and I want all of you, I'm going to guilt you, to go in and watch. It's like 11 minutes. Not now. If you want to listen to the world's experts from across the world, across disciplines, engineering, technology, education, and listen how they are talking and forecasting and prophesying technology to be used, click on that video. You'll see what I'm talking about. First Industrial Revolution, number one under the outline, roughly 1760 to 1830. And again, with all disciplines, there's debate, plus or minus a decade or two, right? I'm going with the generally accepted understanding. But the first Industrial Revolution was from 1760 to 1830. And what were the two things that caused the Industrial Revolution, the first one? Boom. Water turning to steam. So I guess it's one thing, but it's a process that was put on it. So the first Industrial Revolution was water being turned to steam, thereby powering engines. And it literally made machine technology and machine production, particularly in what industry? Back here? Boom, textiles. We don't think about this, right? I mean, again, it's the water we swim. How many of you had to make your own clothes? We homeschool, and we joke that, you know, are you the kind of homeschoolers that make your own clothes? You know, no, we're not. You know, that's a joke in our family. But you don't have to make your own clothes because Old Navy has them for $14. Well, yeah, that's another economic conversation. But having steam allow textile machines to produce 100, and eventually within that time frame, 1,000-fold what a hand weaver could do, revolutionized the textile industry. And thereby, if it revolutionized textile, what else did it revolutionize? Because what are textiles made of? Cotton, wool, all kinds of materials. Well, you get that to the place by transportation. You see what I'm saying? I mean, I know that you didn't know maybe you're coming to church for a history lesson, but this is utterly theological at its foundation. Because before this, before, let's say, 1750, how did you and I, how did our ancestors exist? What was it? Very local, primarily agrarian, poverty level was, I mean, I know if those of you who were here for my lecture last January, this intellectual historians or economic historians call this the inverted hockey stick of economic progress, right? You have from recorded history, 8,000-ish BC, this is GDP. This is 1800. You didn't know you were coming for an economics lesson either. GDP of the average country in 1800, this is called the inverted hockey stick. For almost 10,000 years, there was never many blips. Everybody on the earth was tool-using cultures. Very local, very agrarian, very power top-down. And in the 18th century, they put a round number on it, right? People quibble, plus or minus. 1800, economically, people on the left, people on the right, nobody argues with this. The Industrial Revolution set in motion unprecedented economic growth. Technology does things, but it always undoes things. And we're going to get to some of the rubs and tensions. But nobody argues that we are all economically better off now. That's undisputed. And the first Industrial Revolution, water and steam, allowed that. And it began in what country? What country was the world power in the first Industrial Revolution? Britain. Like Britain, hands down. So you take a, you don't take a break, but things are developing. But then you get into the second industrial revolution, which is 1870 to roughly 1914. Why does it end at 1914? Little thing we called World War I. But the magnifying event of the second industrial revolution is electricity. And electricity allowed you to have mass production. Mass production. Because even steam engines, you couldn't see in the dark very well. And there were certain modes of time and frame. And believe it or not, the clock had a large effect on this too. Who invented the mechanical clock? Who did? You would think, right? Absolutely. That's absolutely. You think that. Who invented the mechanical clock? Yeah. Who? Benedictine monks invented the mechanical clock. And why did they invent it in the 12th century? The seven times of prayer. And there's debate among media ecologists, those who are religiously minded, if they would think that the Benedictine monks would go back and destroy the clock. Because then it was created and taken by factory owners, railroads, etc. Again, that's a whole other class. Time, think about that. Technology in the mechanical clock, invented by religious minded people to get up and sing and pray the liturgy of the hours, was co-opted and then after that fundamentally changed about how you and I think about the world, ordered around time. Technology changes the world. And it changes what it means to be human, because now you and I are governed by clock, time, etc. So electricity, 1870 to 1914, you have the first giant in all of history, you have the first giant industrial corporations that go transnational. You have U.S. Steel, General Electric, Standard Oil, Bayer AG out of Germany. Germany and America start to take over the industrial power. And in roughly 100 years, 1800 to 1900, who becomes the world superpower by 1900? The United States. So most historians quibble again, but it's 1900 is the year that America ascends that world power of the leading economic, war, political power in the world is 1900. And then you get, so World War I ends, and we have a short time of interesting economic times, but what begins shortly after World War I? World War II. What is one of the largest drivers of technology, whether you look at the Egyptians, the Greeks, the Romans, Charles Martel in the 12th century with the stirrup, believe it or not, horses were largely to get infantrymen to the battle, and then horses were kicked out of the way. It wasn't until the stirrup that allowed you to direct a horse and stay on a horse was developed, that then we had what? What kind of military power? If once you could stay on the horse, what developed? Knights, cavalry, the stirrup, and then allowed knights, and then knights took over and became what? Powerful, and they began to break up the different serfdoms and landdoms in the area, and the knights began to have political power, civic power over and against the religious. I mean, seriously, the stirrup. How many of you love horses? How many of you, seriously, how many of you grew up with horses or been on a horse? Okay, I grew up in South Dakota. One of my friends had one of the largest cattle farms in western South Dakota, and I remember as a kid branding. I mean, and this was old school branding, not the like the nice, kind branding they do now, the freezing. I mean, you imagine an 8-year-old kid's moral imagination. A cowboy comes into the arena, grabs the calf, ropes it, flips it over, and I'm watching, and I'm there tending the fire because I'm 8. I'm smaller than half the calves, believe it or not, I was. And they flip it over. They grab a branding iron out of the fire. Another guy has a knife for a certain thing. Another person has a syringe for something else. And they burn it, cut it, and stab it, and then send it on its way. But the stirrup, I never, growing up, and I get up on those horses, we'd go ride the fields where what's the Kevin Costner movie? Dances with Wolves was filmed on this ranch, and the ranch is next to it. I never in my wildest dreams thought when I was getting on that saddle that the stirrup itself was a major technological innovation. All I knew was I gripped it really tight so I didn't fall off. The stirrup changed the world. So back to my original question, what in the world, whether it's the Egyptians, the Greeks, the Romans, the medieval period, or World War I and II, what always is a driver of technology? War. War. If it wasn't for World War I and major chemical interactions that were found to kill millions of people, would the byproduct of that killing be something that we now understand as chemotherapy? Was invented in the same labs as a byproduct, lesser so, of some of the most wicked, evil things ever developed. War, war, war driving technology. So here you have the war settled down, you have the 1950s, the third industrial revolution settles in, the 1950s to the early 2000s. And what do you think? What industry is revolutionized 1950 on? Powered by sand, silica, the electronic industry that burgeoned out of Silicon Valley, Fairchild Semiconductor, the East Coast button-up society. Boston was the Silicon Valley, if you understand that era. Boston was the Silicon Valley. But they were so buttoned up, so entrepreneurship, innovation, it wasn't, you were supposed to stay with the same company, and there were these rebel questioners. That was for my wife, because that's what she calls me. These rebel questioners that said, we're going to move to California because their laws haven't caught up to this honest to God is the truth. If you study the history of the Silicon Valley, Fairchild Semiconductor, etc., their laws didn't catch up with East Coast laws, and it was illegal for you to jump ship. I mean, the laws for you to quit your job and start a similar company were so tight and constrained in the East Coast, it was unbelievable. So a group of men, I think 12, 13-ish, jumped and created eventually Fairchild Semiconductor, which eventually became what? Intel, and others, and the history of, but it was because they could then jump ship, but then they created an innovative culture, and the Californian laws, this is why Silicon Valley grew up, is because you could take that technology and jump and create your own company and entrepreneurship and innovation, boom, 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 boom. So you have this electronic internet technology that automated production. So the first industrial revolution, you have machine production being invented. Second industrial revolution, you have mass production. Third industrial revolution, you have that mass production being automated by machines, robots, etc. And then finally, the fourth industrial revolution, there's a major argument here, 1970s, early 2000s, but now everybody talks about that engages this topic, that we are in the fourth industrial revolution. And this is what makes it distinct. The Protestant Reformation happened how long ago? 501 years, right? We marked that last year pretty big. People flew all over the world, did all the tours. Centuries of development have happened. Who can, in layman's terms, talk to me of what Moore's Law, one of the co-founders of Intel, talked about and popularized this term by his name, of Moore, M-O-O-R-E, Moore's Law. What was is Moore's Law? Does anybody know? It's in a lot of rags, electronic rags.
Computing power doubles about every year.
18 months, but yep. The computing power of the chip doubles. 16, 32, 64. Does that sound familiar? 250, boom, 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 boom. So this is the one thing that sets apart all of the other industrial revolutions. This fourth industrial revolution is set apart by the pace of change. It's not that we haven't had change from the garden till now. The thing that sets us, I work with economists all day long and moral philosophers and people thinking, and I work at a think tank that's largely free market, generally conservative, etc. And so I work with economists who think the free market will solve everything. And I'm generally aligned with that. But rarely do the economists I talk with talk about what technology undoes. They talk about people in aggregate. Because how else are we supposed to understand the mountains of data that all of this information in the world has now? It's data, mountains, reams of data. No matter what industry you're in, you can go, if you've ever been to a conference at one of your industries, right? Think about the reams of data. This is what's called an epistemological problem. How you know what you know. How do you make sense of the data? How do you bring meaning to the data? We have data. We have unprecedented information. That's why most of you have like 10,000 commentaries on this phone. You can download Bibles, Bible apps, commentaries. You get Logos. There are all these things that can make you a better student. You have unprecedented access to information. Does that make you wise? This is the perennial question. Just because we have unprecedented access to information, the pace at which this is happening, nobody knows what's going on. No one. And yet the major mantra is it will change what it means to be human. Translate that, we want it to change. It's a positive. Go and watch this video. We want the fourth industrial revolution to change what it means to be human. So the fourth industrial revolution is the fusion of technology that blurs the line between physical, digital, and biological. Fusion of technology that blurs the lines between physical, digital, and biological. And it is distinct because of these three things. You can write it down. The modern fourth industrial revolution that you and I, it's the water we're swimming in, even if we don't notice it. It's the velocity, the scope, and the system impact that sets this apart from all the other industrial revolutions. The velocity, the speed, the pace. The velocity, the scope, you can't go to any country or any industry where this hasn't touched. You cannot go to any, so the other industrial revolutions largely hit what kind of worker? When industrial revolutions happened, what kind of worker was affected, at least very, at the early stages? Tradesmen, how would we argue or articulate that today? Blue collar, generally the easiest things to be replaced. The fourth industrial revolution, you know what one of the quickest professions that's going out of style? Becoming a lawyer and becoming a medical doctor of a certain kind. Radiology. Discovery. Those of you who are attorneys or know what attorneys do, these hot law firms hire a lot of people, and what they do is they work 80 to 120 hours a week, and they work on discovery for the first 5 or 7 years of their career. Well, discovery is now done in many major law firms by computer. So what's different is that obviously tradesmen, because you hear of truck drivers, right, are going to be automated out, these truck caravans, etc. You hear the low line, but this is the first industrial revolution that is radically across all sector changing. So some people say, have you seen the magazine center covers, robots will take your, will robot take your job? Have you seen that? I mean, it's on TV, it's everywhere. Well, that's the wrong question. They don't fundamentally don't understand what it is. Robots aren't going to take jobs. Robots take what? It's a T word. Robots don't take jobs, they take tasks. And I know the mark of a well-trained mind is the ability to make distinctions. The mark of a well-trained mind is the ability to make distinctions. And what robots, they're not going to take jobs, they take tasks. And so understanding the future, what tasks are most likely to be automated, or we will still have bankers, we will still have lawyers, we'll have less of them. It's going to affect the velocity, the speed, the scope across all industry, and finally, systems impact. Because we are a more globalized world, it just follows that these systems will infect everything. And it's evolving at an exponential rather than linear pace. Back to that Moore's Law idea. The thinkers on this are extrapolating Moore's Law and understanding on the computer chip to everyday life, not just the computer chip. It's the pace, the doubling, the hyper change. In fact, the change happened so fast that Africa, there was never a boom in the personal computer or laptop in Africa. The pace happened so fast, what does Africa now outstrip Americans in usage of? For what? Are they playing Candy Crush? That's what we do. They use it for mobile banking, mobile insurance. There's a new medical app for Africans in Nairobi being rolled out for 400,000 people so that they can get basic medical insurance on their phone. PCs were never a thing. And they now have leapfrogged us in usage of this technology here. So, I'm going to end with this. We have to go get our kids. I don't know if this was anything like what you expected. But I want these questions to haunt you. I want this 8 weeks to be somewhat haunting. To think about the technologies we use. And I promise you, we will get this more churchy. We will talk theologically. We will talk chapter and verse. But I wanted to set up a metaphysical argument. An argument of ontology. Who we are by our nature has been very important to theologians since the beginning of the scriptures. Who we are as human beings, what I am made to do, how I look at my work, how I look at each other, how I look at fellow humans made in the image of God to be co-creative, and that we all have different gifts and skills. The technologists who are over the technopolies want us to drop that is antiquated thinking about what it means to be human. And so I'll leave you with this quote from Paul Goodman. Whether or not it draws on new scientific research, technology is a branch of moral philosophy, not science. Whether or not it draws on new scientific research, technology is a branch of moral philosophy, not science. It's how we relate to each other in the incarnation that makes us fundamentally Christian. And there are waters in which we swim that are trying to change the fundamental nature of what it means to be human. And our technologies must be thought about not only what it does for us, but what it undoes. And I'll get to more practical examples in my next time. Thank you.